Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
I wrote this memoir to let people know that people you hear about in the news, Syria, the refugees, they're actually real people with like stories and families and dreams. We're not just numbers. We're not random pictures of people suffering that you just don't know, or you just sometimes you just don't care anymore about them. I wrote this memoir to give people who didn't get the chance to talk a voice. There's millions of people who went through a lot of terrible things, perhaps more terrifying than the things that I went through.
I and my friends had hoped that humankind would come to our aid. Afterwards, I gave up on humanity. There is nothing worse than feeling the world has forgotten you. The compelling words of Cassie Mead from his memoir My Country, published by Bloomsbury. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. What has been the human cost of Syria's civil war? How did this war happen to ordinary people? And what was it like being a Palestinian refugee living in Bashar al-Assad's Syria? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to tackle those questions with writer, human rights activist and journalist Cassie Mead, whose powerful memoir, My Country, has just been published by Bloomsbury, where Cassie writes, "Starvation was a main tactic in the regime's new strategy, and it proved to be their most effective weapon. Some residents stayed because they were simply afraid to pass through the checkpoints, lacked the funds to leave, or preferred to die in their own homes. It's hard for me to say what kept me there." Kasim goes on to state, "I was lucky enough to live to tell this tale while so many others struggled, fought and died silently. I have written this memoir for them. I hope that it will give a voice to those who are suffering now and to those who have been silenced forever, and that people of conscience around the world will listen before it's too late." So, has the world forgotten about Syria? And is it possible to move on from the psychological wounds of war?
Hello, my name is Qasim Eid. I'm a Palestinian-Syrian activist and a rebel, and also the author of My Country, a Syrian Memoir.
Really well done on the memoir, Cassim. I have to say it is an unbelievably powerful read. It's very raw in some parts. It's very emotionally engaging in other parts, and also incredibly informative on the state of play in Syria and what so many Syrians, Palestinian Syrians and the general community have gone through. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off, and sure, we can take it from there. What does it mean to be a refugee today? What does it mean to you?
Well, actually, it's my life right now. I've been a refugee, to be honest, since the day I was born in Syria, because I was born in Syria, a Palestinian-Syrian refugee, because my father and mother were kicked out of Palestine in 1948, and I was born in Syria under refugee status. In Syria, I went through the same struggles that young people like me in Syria had to go through. And eventually, when the revolution happened, we were hoping to make our country a better place for everyone to stay. But unfortunately, because of the Assad regime atrocities and other terrorist groups, we had to flee the country. I fled Syria. I became a refugee in the United States in 2014. Then I became a refugee for the third time in my life in Germany in 2016.
You say in the memoir, you write in the memoir that Palestinians living in Syria could never fully integrate into society and remained refugees without the full rights of citizens. I'm just wondering, how do you explain that?
Well, the fact that the Assad regime and practically all other Arab and Muslim dictators always use Palestine and Palestinians as a way to justify their dictatorship. While in fact, in real life, they all treat Palestinians in a very bad way, a very different way than they treat the rest of their people. In Syria, the Assad government didn't allow Palestinians, for example, to have certain jobs in the government or in the military. When even in school, there was a lot of discrimination against us. They actually named one of the worst intelligence branches in Syria as the Palestine branch, which was practically the slaughterhouse even before the revolution. In the very early days of the Syrian revolution, when people were still demonstrating in Daraa after the regime tortured those school children, the Assad regime vice president and spokesperson, Bouthaina Shaaban, accused Palestinian refugees in Daraa of making problems and demonstrating against the government. So Palestinians in Syria were always treated in a very, very bad way.
You arrived to Germany, I think it was in May 2016, and then you began writing the memoir. You opened the memoir saying, "I came to Germany as a broken man." And I'm just wondering, throughout the memoir, it strikes me that, you know, you're a very resilient fellow, you're a very courageous fellow, a very hopeful fellow. And within all of that, there is a lot of creativity in how you went about surviving through some brutal, grotesque and unimaginable violence. So I'm just wondering, for anyone who hasn't read the memoir, how would you describe it? Because to me, it is a story of hope, survival and of courage.
Well, thank you so much for your kind words. When I wrote in the memoir that I came to Germany as a broken man, to be honest, the thing that actually broke me or made me feel very disappointed was the lack of international community action against the atrocities and war criminals in Syria. That's the thing that really broke my heart, because I grew up in a dictatorship that always taught us in school that, you know, the United States is the enemy, Europe is the enemy, democracy is such an evil and bad thing. They used to praise Hitler and praise dictators like Stalin and others in our history books and say they were great leaders just because they stood against the West. Millions of people in Syria during the revolution, we were hoping that the international community, and especially the West, the United States and Europe, will actually take action to support our claims in democracy and freedom in Syria. Later on, our hopes started to become more about stopping the atrocities. And with years passing by, and maybe more than 700,000 people got killed and millions of people got displaced, it's the disappointment that actually didn't just break me. It broke a lot of hearts in Syria.
But when you look at the last couple of years and the devastation, the brutality and the violence affecting Syrians all across the country, it is astounding to think how, whether it's Europe, whether it's America or different political groups, how people have not, I would say, forgotten or chosen to ignore, but they've left what has happened and happen again and happen again.
Yes. That's that was really painful and disappointing to watch throughout those years with atrocities and war crimes. It's not just the chemical weapons the massacre that I survived in August 21st, 2013, when 1,400 people were killed in few hours by the Assad regime. There is hundreds of massacres. There is, for example, the Caesar file about police defector who filmed and smuggled the pictures of more than 55,000 people who got tortured to death in Assad prisons. There is the crematorium in Saydnaya, where more than 100,000 people were brutally tortured to death and burned inside those big ovens to hide the evidence. The list of the atrocities and war crimes in Syria, it's really, really shocking for anyone who is actually interested to dig further into the truth in Syria. And as an activist who has been doing this for many years, I don't know, the disappointment is just too much to bear. It's really too much.
You write, in times of war, our natural disaster hope is priceless. It can make up for low ammunition, food shortages, stress, fatigue, and almost any physical ailment. Can you talk me through that? Because possibly not everyone can maintain a sense of hope through massive violent onslaughts day in, day out.
Yeah, well, like I mentioned earlier, we were going through atrocities. We were going through chemical weapons, siege, starvation, daily bombardment. I watched my friends die. I watched my own town getting destroyed by my own government. It was all too much to handle. But again, the thing that took away our hope in resistance or our hope in some kind of help coming into the way was just, again, watching how the world leaders, the international community, giving Assad a green pass to keep committing atrocities. That hope that we had was one day we'll be able to take our country back from the Assad government, from ISIS, from all those terrorists, and actually rebuild our country and make it a better place for everyone in Syria. But that hope got crushed. That's all I can say. And through all the past years, where the Russians and the Iranians started to interfere heavily in the Syrian conflict and it committing more atrocities. I don't know. You can see right now how people are surrendering in Syria or just trying to do anything just to be able to live and move on with their lives. It's really heartbreaking.
Kasim, can I get you to describe what everyday life was like growing up in your hometown of Mawadi Maya? You have these beautiful descriptions of the fruits and vegetables that were growing. And obviously there was, you know, different communities living side by side, somewhat distrustful of each other. But you present a great feeling of community and a great spirit amongst the town before the siege took place. So can you just describe that for me, please?
Life in Syria was very, very simple and yet complicated. It was very simple and nice because of the people in Syria were very kind and very nice and very loving. The community was very simple. People used to look after each other and like help each other. For example, Maddamia was a very small, beautiful town with a lot of olive trees, fig trees, apple trees. There was a lot of farms where people have chickens and like cows and horses and everything. The community used to, you know, help each other out during really hard days or bad times. For example, when my father passed away in 1999, our neighbors and our like people from the community, from the town, try to help us, try to stand by our side and like look after our needs and things like that. But in the same time, the complications come from the government, from the Assad government, because of their brutality. You know, we used to have a famous saying in Syria about how the walls have ears, that we cannot discuss anything that has to do with politics in anywhere, especially when it comes about Syria. For example, you can see people, or I remember watching my late father and neighbors talking about, you know, the United States or maybe Russia or like China sometimes, but never talking about Syria. And I found that very weird until I later on grew up and started to understand that walls do have ears in Syria.
So there was this palpable paranoia, if you will, always lurking there somewhere in the background, but nobody was willing possibly to put a name on it, whether it was the looming name of al-Assad when he came into power in 2000, or possibly the inequalities between, you know, the Alawite minority and then the rest of you.
That's absolutely true. Like the Assad regime, who always claimed that he's a protector of minorities. In fact, the Assad regime used minorities, and especially the Alawites, to establish a rule of minorities in Syria, and to keep people hating each other and push them away from each other, even if it was hidden. You know, for example, all the top sensitive positions in the government were for the Alawite minority, and the military and the intelligence. All the new businesses that Assad opened up, it was practically run by his cousin Rami Makhlouf or other people, businessmen from his own minority. And that led to a lot of injustice in Syria. And even though people were trying to get along or looked like they are getting along with it, but at the end, it made the situation, especially the economic situation for most of the country, very, very bad, because you know, again, they were distributing the wealth and the powerful positions among the Alawite community and leaving more than 90% of the Syrian population blowing in the wind.
A lot of Syrians would have had a lot of hope, you know, 18 years ago when al-Assad came into power. He, you know, he spoke openly that he wanted to liberalise the country in some way, that he wanted to make lots of different reforms, and that, you know, he wouldn't be as heavy-handed as his father. But you write very movingly about this inequality that was brought in, because in a lot of ways his father was quite transparent in his iron-fisted ways, whereas his son was way more manipulating, tricky and controlling, but in a very secretive way. So he built this very protected regime in a very secretive way, that it all kind of crept up upon the people. Would that be fair to say?
I think that would be very fair to say. Hafez al-Assad was better in wearing masks and hiding the true nature of the regime. And even some of the positions in the government, Hafez al-Assad gave for Sunni officers or ministers. But Bashar al-Assad openly and practically, like publicly, gave all the you know, all the wealth, all the businesses to his cousins and relatives, who most of them were just, you know, money laundering his own wealth. And throughout the years, that mask Bashar al-Assad tried to put in his early years as a president, saying that he wants to open the country and liberate, some of the injustices in Syria. Turned out to be a very false claim, because we only saw his cousins and his family growing wealthier while the rest of the Syrian people kept drowning in poverty.
You describe your schooling and, you came from a very educated family. Your father worked for Syrian TV. He was an editor, and he was very adept and shrewd at dealing and working around the restrictions within the regime. And your mother seems to have, always been very kind of worried about all her children, how they were going to navigate all the different restrictions. And you were quite outspoken, and you describe how, you had different problems with different teachers, and you weren't willing to kind of, I suppose, robotically go through school life. And on your way home from school, I think you must have been around 16 or 17, and you got lifted by the police. You were interrogated, and you were pretty much roughed up. You were very young to go through that at the time, and if that probably seems like a walk in the park now, considering what you went through subsequently. But could you have ever believed what was yet to happen?
Actually, I never thought that they will use this kind of firepower, this kind of brutality, like you described it. Old problems, or the old things that the regime used to do to us before the revolution, seemed like a walk in the park. We never expected that the regime will use chemical weapons, for example, or airplanes to actually bomb us. But again, the thing that shocked us the most after a year or two in the revolution, after we saw how much atrocities the regime is doing, the thing that shocked us the most was actually watching the world looking at Bashar al-Assad and doing nothing. The regime has history, a long history of committing mass murder and atrocities. For example, Hafez al-Assad, Bashar's father, in 1982, he killed more than 50,000 people in the city of Hama and displaced hundreds of thousands of Syrians outside the country. Most of the Syrian community you see in Europe or the States actually came there in the early 80s during that time. And now there's the second wave of the Syrian refugees coming after 2011. So with all that in mind, we were really shocked by what Bashar al-Assad did, and we were shocked even more about how the world just kept on watching and letting Assad get away with it.
You describe very movingly the series of protests that took place from March 2011, and then you go into the horrific reality of how so many women in your village were sexually assaulted, violently sexually assaulted, in order to punish the entire village and punish the men in the village, to psychologically punish them. And then later, you describe what was called the Martyrs' Graveyard. And it's an incredibly moving part of the memoir, on the bravery of your fellow villagers in trying to give proper dignity to those who had died, and how they tried to bury local villagers and risk their own lives to help and bury their local villagers. Can you tell me about that? Because I can only imagine, from reading it, it was incredibly powerful to read. But you not only wrote about this, you went through this, you have lived through this.
Well, that was one of the most terrifying things that I went through in my life. And I went through a lot because of the Assad regime. Trying to bury people after they were bombed by airplanes or shot by the Assad regime, or sometimes tortured to death, was something that takes a lot of courage, takes a lot of strength to actually be physically and mentally able to do. I talk in the memoir about one incident when I helped burying a man who was trying to get medicine to his daughter. during the siege, and the Assad government arrested him, and they tortured him for days and burned his body with acid and stabbed him with knives and all, other things. That night, when I was trying to bury that man, was one of the most terrifying nights in my life, because of the way he smelled, because of the way he looked. Just looking at his eyes and seeing how much terror and pain he went through before he died. Something that I will never forget, and I will never forgive the people who done that to that man, to that poor man who was just trying to get medicine to his dying daughter.
You write that after the chemicals attack that, you know, you never wanted to fight, and that you were, I suppose you believed in pacifism, and you didn't believe in any way the violence, more violence would solve the problem. But in those moments, you decided that you had to fight and you had to stand up, and that was the only way forward. That must have been, in one way, a very intuitive decision to make, given all the carnage and horror that you're surrounded with. But on a kind of a personal, moral, philosophical level, you must have also been haunted by that decision.
Well, I can say not anymore, because after I saw that the regime kept committing atrocities and kept killing people, I'm actually proud that I one day got the chance to fight those monsters on the ground. The time or the days before and after I decided to fight for the very first time were very, very hard days in my life. It was very, very difficult. We were going through siege and starvation, and then the regime used chemical weapons, and after I survived the massacre, the regime was trying to invade and kill and rape whoever remained alive. And that was the moment when I decided that holding a camera or holding a keyboard or holding a pen won't stop those monsters. Only a gun will stop those monsters from killing us and committing more massacres and atrocities. And I'm proud that I fought that day, and I'm proud that I fought after. And I really hope that one day I will get the chance again to fight the Assad regime and whoever terrorist, whatever terrorist who will come to his aid, and actually be able to go back to my country and help people start their lives and have some kind of dignity and freedom in a country that paid a very, very heavy price for freedom and democracy.
A lot of your brothers, and I know your mum is based now in Jordan, but a lot of your brothers and family members had fled Syria, some to England, some to places in Europe, and some others around Jordan and around the Middle East. You must have felt a huge amount of, you know, one, pressure from your family to get out because they were worried about you, and they were willing to help you get out. But then you felt a responsibility to your country and to your village that you had to fight and stay there. So can you talk me through that? Because you must have been in a very conflicted situation. Most people's instinct will be, get the hell out. Save your own skin. But you took a very different route. And then eventually you went on hunger strike and you gave witness testimonials to the international media about what was happening in your country. So that was incredibly brave. Other people could possibly see that as crazy. So can you talk me through that?
Like I told you, I was born a refugee in Syria. And even though the government didn't treat us fairly, most of the Syrian people did. And for me, Syria is the only country that I know. So when the Syrian revolution started, I felt obligated to take part and to help the people in Syria win their freedom and have their dreams. And especially because I'm Palestinian, and the regime always used us as an excuse to oppress the Syrian people and take their freedom and take their dignity from them, because they always claim they want to fight Israel and send Palestinians back to Palestine. I participated in the revolution, and I felt that I have to do whatever I can to help the people in Syria win their freedom. And I'm very proud about taking that stand, and I hope one day I'll be able to help them more and hopefully see our dream coming true and having a free elected government in Syria instead of the tyrant Bashar al-Assad.
You write how lonely and how abandoned you felt when you went on the hunger strike. And I have to say, the diary entries that you have in the memoir, you kept a diary all through the hunger strike. I think you strike for nearly 30 days. It makes for very profound, powerful and very, very moving reading. But I'm just wondering, how did you keep on going through all of that? Because feeling that lonely and feeling that abandoned, that I'm sure your mind played terrible tricks with you. Was anybody listening? Did anybody care? Like, to keep going on, to keep your kind of psychological balance, if you will, in place, must have been an unbelievable battle.
It was probably the hardest battle to face, to just stay mentally and physically well, because surviving takes a lot of energy. Going through atrocities and bombs and massacres almost every day, and worst of all, going through hunger and going through starvation and low temperatures without heat, without power, was very, very hard. Watching my friends melt and just die out of hunger, watching myself losing a lot of weight and, I don't know, drowning in this really terrible feeling of loneliness and disappointment by the entire world. It was a feeling that was shared maybe all over the town. People were turning literally into ghosts because of the starvation and the low temperatures. So I had to, I don't know, gather all the faith that I have in my heart and all the strength that I had to just keep on going. And writing was some kind of, it was helpful. And I don't know, I had to play tricks of my own to be able to keep going.
When you say you found the writing helpful in terms of writing the diaries, having a journal of what your head was going through, your heart was going through, what your soul was going through, if you will, do you think that, you know, that that can, in ways, it kind of had a cathartic effect of some sort, or released you in some way, or could, you know, allow you to then to make the next step?
I will say that's true, because, you know, for me, writing was always a way out. An escape, and also in many ways a gun to point at people who are using propaganda or lying about the truth in Syria. So writing was always a way for me to fight back, and always a way for me to find some kind of peace of mind and, in this very difficult and terrible situation.
I presume going through what you've gone through and all the terrible violence and brutality that you've seen has challenged your faith in humanity and also your belief in a God, wherever or whatever that God is, has it?
Well, it's true. It did challenge my faith in humanity and did challenge my faith in God and challenge my faith in everything I actually believed in. Because, you know, I lived my entire life just like the rest of the people in Syria. We were living in under an iron curtain of lies and corruption. When the revolution started, we started seeing a lot of masks drop. And it wasn't just from the regime. We saw a lot of, we call them shiuch, clerics who stood by the regime and said that we are traitors and we deserve to die. We saw a lot of our neighbors or our friends turning against us and holding weapons and trying to kill trying to kill us. So all this madness, challenged any kind of prior knowledge about anything we thought we know in life, because we found out that there was a lot of lies in our lives. We found out that a lot of those shiny, sparkly, whatever mottos that the UN, the US, and the international community and other countries were just dealing with hypocrisy about the Syrian atrocity. They let the war criminal who killed hundreds of thousands of people and displaced millions of people walk away unpunished, and now he's trying to stay in power and try to rebuild the same cities and towns that he destroyed, and do just, I don't know, escape punishment perhaps forever. This is the hypocrisy that we can never, never understand or deal with.
Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with writer, human rights activist and journalist Cassa Mead, whose new memoir, My Country, has just been published by Bloomsbury, where Cassa writes, "Leaving your country during a conflict is probably one of the worst emotional experiences anyone can go through. I was confused, afraid, disappointed, happy I was safe, but sad that this might be the last time I would ever see my home. For the next 3 weeks, I found safety with strangers and took great care to avoid old friends. Old friends were dangerous. I could never tell if they had been blackmailed into working for the Assad regime. Most of the people I stayed with in Lebanon were foreign reporters I'd known only through Skype. They turned out to be some of the best people I've met in my life, because they cared about me, even though they had no reason to. I continued talking to the media about the situation in Syria and about Assad's crimes. I denounced the local ceasefires, which I saw as tactical moves to escape international pressure to lift the sieges. In Lebanon, I was stunned by the kindness of people I barely knew. Though I was ashamed to accept so much help, I accepted it nonetheless, because I craved more than anything the feeling that I had not been abandoned. The kindness I received was a touching reminder that, despite all I had suffered and all the friends I had lost, that there was still a lot of good in the world. For a long time after I arrived in the United States, I felt like I was daydreaming. A Syrian American who I knew through a fellow activist picked me up at the airport and took me to his house, where he and his wife fed me turkey and mashed potatoes. We went on a driving tour of Virginia. I was amazed at the lush green fields and open spaces. And we visited downtown Washington, where I saw monuments that I'd only seen before in the news. Everything felt so strange. The people, the malls, the trams, the restaurants. I asked Kasim what propels him forward and whether it was a mixture of hope, anger and frustration.
It is knowing that there is really nice and good people around the world that I keep meeting when I travel. People who are willing to help, people who are willing to actually learn about what really happened in Syria. Those normal, kind people are the ones who give me hope and give me strength to keep going and to hope for a better tomorrow, to hope that one day we will be able to spread knowledge about what really happened in Syria, because there's a lot of propaganda. There's a war on truth, not just in Syria, all over the world. And hopefully one day we will be able to educate people about what really happened, and we will bring war criminals to justice, and we will be able to have the dream of just having free elections and democratic government in Syria.
And Kasim, what is your hope with the memoir, My Country? It's an unbelievable read. When I read the book in one sitting, I went out in a really long cycle afterwards. I didn't know what to do. I didn't even know how to respond, because it's such a moving, powerful and also a very frightening story and a very brave story. So I'm wondering, clearly you want to bring, you know, readers to Syria and what has happened and make people think. But what do you want them to reflect upon, and what do you think should be the response to anybody? What is the moral response, I suppose, to anyone that reads your book? Because it is about morality, it is about community, it is about solidarity and people, and, you know, what we're willing to stand up to and what we're willing to support, isn't it?
It is absolutely true. I wrote this memoir to let people know that people you hear about in the news, Syria, the refugees, they're actually real people with, like, stories and families and dreams. We're not just numbers. We're not random pictures of people suffering that you just don't know, or you just, sometimes you just don't care anymore about them. I wrote this memoir to give people who didn't get the chance to talk a voice. There's millions of people who went through a lot of terrible things, perhaps more terrifying than the things that I went through, but they never got the chance to talk. And I was blessed to be able to talk and to get my voice around the world. And I've dedicated myself and dedicated my voice for the truth about what happened in Syria. And I really hope whoever is going to read my memoir, to just remember us as human beings, not as refugees, not as victims, not as anything else, just another human being on this earth who went through bad things and who really, really needs your help.
And if you had the earshot of powerful players in society, political leaders and big political groups, what would you say to them?
First, I will start saying if there are people in the government, I will tell them, shame on you. And I want to tell those powerful people, why did you wait so long? We can never have reconciliation or reconstruction of the country without having the war criminals brought into justice. How can we forget and forgive and move on and build a new country and have the refugees coming back while the same murderers and the same war criminals are still in power, where day after day we still have hundreds of people getting arrested and brutally tortured to death, have women raped and families destroyed. We cannot wait any longer. We need your help now, not tomorrow, not the day after. We need it right now.
That was writer, human rights activist and journalist Cassie Mead. My Country, a Syrian memoir, is published by Bloomsbury and retails for just under €18 in hardback. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say thank you for listening and a big shout out to the lovely Jojo on sound. We've been Talking Books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the words of Cassie Mead from his humbling memoir, My Country. I am now a refugee three times over, born a Palestinian refugee in Syria, displaced from my Syrian homeland alongside millions of others, only to become a refugee again after I left the United States to try and return to my country. Refugees are now a nation unto themselves. We have no land, no flag, and no government. Although we do have our own Olympic team. But if we were to coalesce, we would form a nation larger than France or the United Kingdom. So before you blame or judge us all, try to understand who we are and why we've become refugees. Try to imagine yourself living in our shoes just for one day. Courageous words indeed. Good night.